God's patient love is illustrated on a number of occasions in Scripture. I think about David, who committed adultery, who committed murder, who went on living for a year as if nothing had ever happened. I think about Jonah, who decided to play hide and go seek with God. That didn't work out very well. I think about a woman by the name of Rahab. If you open her closet, there were a lot of skeletons to fall out. I think about the woman taken in adultery. I think about Peter, that vacillating boaster turned coward. I'll never deny him. I don't know the man. I do not know him. I think about Saul of Tarsus holding the coats of those who stoned Stephen, the champion of the Pharisees against Christ. But as I read my Bible, what impresses me most is that God's love was so patient, so merciful, so long-suffering that he refused to give up on the likes of all of those people. And that is amazing to me. But the most amazing of all, ladies and gentlemen, is not their stories, but mine. For the most amazing fact of all is that he refuses to give up on me. And he refuses to give up on you. The message this morning is, it's never too late to turn around. It's never too late to start doing what's right. It's never too late to come home. And no story illustrates that better than the story of the prodigal son. It's in Luke 15, beginning in verse 11, and I won't reread what was already read in your hearing moments ago. But chances are you know that story very well. It is a message that is so simple. The little children here today can understand the storyline. And yet, at the same time, it is a message so profound that even scholars have been unable to exhaust its implications. We don't use the word prodigal anymore, except in this context. It was an old English word that meant reckless wastefulness. It carries with it overtones of promiscuity and moral debauchery, self-indulgence to the max. As you read the story of this young man, he becomes a living picture of where sin will take you and how that if you leave sin unchecked, it will destroy you. If you have your notes on the back page of the bulletin today, look at his shameless demand. As he dishonors both father and family. Give me the share of the estate that falls to me, he demanded. Everything about that demand, ladies and gentlemen, cuts cross grain against the very core values of the Hebrew society. Remember the commandment? It was very prominent. Exodus 20:12. You shall honor your father and mother. And he did anything but that. Perhaps he was in his late teens, maybe early 20s. But his defiant request reveals to us the deep-seated hatred he had for father and family. He had no ounce of gratitude for any kind of family legacy. He had no respect for the hard-working father that he had and for the life that his dad provided him. He had no patience. He had no discipline. He was in love with himself. And I've got a mental picture of this young man as he comes in perhaps one day from a friend's house and he goes up to his room and he begins to start thinking about how much fun it would be to finally be out from under all of the restraints of home. How much fun it would be to control his own affairs. How much fun it would be to have his own money and to do with that money whatever he, not his dad, whatever he wanted to do. And so in my mind, I play out the scene. And I see the young man coming down, and there sits his dad. And he comes up to his dad and he says, "Okay, old man, I have had it up to here with all of these rules and regulations, and I've got some things coming to me, and I want them now to do with as I please." You know what he's really saying to his dad? "Dad, I wish you were dead." I think that's usually when you get your inheritance. He's saying to his father, "You're the one standing between me and my plans. You're the one hindering me from all of my freedom. You know, if you were dead, I could cash in and be gone. But apparently you're not going to die, so I want my money now. I want my inheritance. I want my freedom. I want my life. I want out of this family. I want out now." The story as Jesus tells it is bizarre, because he tells it in a culture where honor of family was so important and where the fifth commandment was law. And so the young man's brashness, his insolence, is scandalous. Any child who would make that kind of brazen demand deserves to be written off, dismissed from the family, reckoned as dead. And in some ways, that's how he is betrayed. Or portrayed. Look in verse 24. "Remember, this son of mine was dead and has come to life again." Look again in verse 32. "We had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead." There it is again. Reckoned as dead. You know, whatever was in his young mind, the boy was either absolutely oblivious to shame, or he just didn't care. So what if his behavior brought dishonor to this family? So what if he thrust the dagger into the heart of his father? So what? I want it all, and I want it now. As Jesus tells the story, he could hardly paint a portrait of greater shame. Now, sadly, in that era, like our own, everybody tends to know everybody else's business. It's not hard to imagine that in a very short time, this child's rebellion would be public knowledge. Everybody's going to find out about this. But he didn't care. The boy didn't care if I cast shame upon my father, my family, my own reputation. He just didn't care. Now, equally sad is that there wasn't one thing the father could do to ease the pain of his prodigal son. He could engage in public denunciation. He could give his son a ceremonial slap in the face. He could hold a formal dismissal from the family. He could even hold a mock funeral. And I'm sure that's what the Pharisees were expecting to come out of the story of Jesus and the prodigal son. But in the story, what Jesus did, or what this father did next, was absolutely shocking. Look in verse 12. The end of the verse. "So the father divided his wealth between them." "Give me the share of the estate that falls to me." And guess what? The Father gave it to him. You can just see the antennas going up on the Pharisees. This is unheard of. As scandalous as was the boy, equally, if not more so, is the scandal now the father. And the Pharisees, as they're listening to this story, are thinking to themselves, can you believe this? Can you believe that he allowed the boy to have his way? What self-respecting father would ever let a rebellious child have his way? Two fathers. There's the father in the story. He did that. And there's the father in your story. Because God has done that for you. You see, we're the prodigal. Jesus isn't telling the story so people can just marvel and say, oh, Jesus, the great storyteller. There was always a point. The father in the story is God. And as the father in the story, he has the absolute power. God has the prerogative to destroy every sinner in an instant. What does God do instead? He extends to every prodigal son and daughter what? Mercy and patience. And rather than destroying us, he forbears with us. And if you read Romans chapter 1, what you find is sometimes he allows us to have what we think we want to have. He allows us the freedom to fail. And he allows us the freedom to fail even though our failure brings him great dishonor and shame. Hebrews 12 and verse 2. He endured the cross despising the shame. Sometimes God lets us have our way because he knows some of us have to learn the hard way. Kind of like this young man. Well, you know the story. What comes next is as deplorable as it is predictable. There's an absolute meltdown. And if you look in verse 13, it did not take long for his agenda to become clear. Verse 13 says, not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey. Fed up with all the responsibility, tired of being accountable, sick of living at home, he could hardly wait, liquefy the assets, and hit the road. Didn't care about his family, didn't care about his father's property and livestock and his work. He sold his birthright in yard sale fashion. Pennies on the dollar. He just wanted out. Maybe there's something else here you have not seen. Jesus is telling this story to a Jewish audience. And when he says in verse 13 that he journeyed to a distant country, translate, he journeyed to a Gentile country, which says not only was this boy leaving home and family, he's walking away from his faith. What this kid did was unthinkable. How bad was this kid? He is so bad he has absolute scorn for his father, his family, and his faith. There's no way, as Jesus tells the story, that he could have possibly painted this boy in a worse kind of light. I mean, you would expect the father, give him his funeral now, invite the whole village, tell everybody what he's done as if they don't already know, and as the father, pronounce him dead to you. Good riddance. If there's anybody beyond redemption, it's this boy. By the way, where did he go? Well, he wanted to go somewhere exotic, obviously. Somewhere exciting. He wanted to go somewhere that he'd heard about. And so with his liquefied assets, with cash, if we put it in terms of our vernacular in our day, he headed for the strip in Vegas. Now I'll be very painfully honest. people who think like this kid don't think far ahead. You see at the end of verse 13? And there he squandered his estate with loose living. That's no surprise. The Greek word squandered means wasted. It was used in the process of winnowing. The grain would be tossed up into the air and the wind would blow away the chaff. That's the word. What he's saying is he took his money, he took his inheritance and just threw it up in the air and the wind just blew it away. He squandered it. He wasted it. In fact, in verse 30, if you skip ahead, the elder brother says, when this son of yours came who has devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. He pursued a life of immorality. He sowed his wild oats. He went after every woman he could find. And in so doing, he violated a very fundamental law of creation that a man will reap what he sows. This kid trashed his life. Now, you and I understand. We know that sin doesn't deliver. That it will always take you farther than you want to go. It will always cost you more than you're willing to pay, and it will always keep you there longer than you want to stay. Romans 6 and verse 23 says, the wages of sin is death. It will separate you from God. 2 Peter 2 and verse 19, for by what a man is overcome, by this is he enslaved. This young man is getting ready to discover a very painful truth about life. Look closely at verse 14. When he had spent everything. What's the old saying? A fool and his money are soon parted. This kid rolls into town as the fat cat with a lot of cash. You know, the naive kid from the country. And everybody in town knew who he was because he was so generous and fun-loving. He was rich and looking for a good time. And there were plenty of people who would be glad to accommodate. Plenty of people who would claim to be his friends, but they weren't friends. They were scum. And yes, a fool and his money are soon parted. You see that in verse 14? He spent everything. Later, the elder brother told his dad, don't you know what he's done? He has spent your wealth on prostitutes, on harlots, on whores. He has sown his wild oats. And now there would be a harvest. In the story in verse 14, as he's in this distant place, this severe famine occurs. Now, that wasn't his fault. It wasn't. The truth is, life is hard, and some days it gets harder. And the problem was, his whole life until now had not been hard. He thought maybe it had. His life until this point had been relatively easy. That's getting ready to change. And so he sells his soul for a good time. And now life, providence, is calling the account with interest. And for the first time in his life, if you look at the end of verse 14, he began to be impoverished. And how bad was it? Verse 15, he went and hired himself to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. That kind of desperation is foreign to us. You know, it is so easy for us to be spoiled and not even know it. I think he was spoiled and didn't even know it. He'd had it pretty easy. even though he'd had to work. It looks to me like his dad took care of him, provided him everything he needed. But his dream turns out to be a nightmarish horror. And now in that distant Gentile land, he's without family. He's without friends. And because he's thrown away his faith, he's without hope. He's all alone. He's got nowhere to turn. And the party's over. The party is over. I tell you what I want to do in the month of March. I want to study the story of the prodigal son. And I want to study the story of the prodigal son in greater detail and depth and application than maybe you've been used to studying. There's several lessons I want to do with you and explore with you this very famous story of Jesus. There's some things I think we can draw from this that I think will help all of us. So we'll stop right there. Verse 17 says, he came to his senses. It's often said that you have to hit bottom before you find your turning point. That's true. The question this morning is, have you hit bottom? How low does a person have to go in life before they finally say, that's it, that's enough, I'm going to go home? And he did. And when he went home, what he found, instead of the wagging, shaking finger of his father in his face, instead of a long, I told you so speech, what he found was the open arms of a father who was willing to take him back. You see, you're the prodigal. I'm the prodigal. God's the father. And he waits for his children to come home, to come back to him. And he waits with open arms. And our Father waits with open arms. There's joy in the presence of God and his angels over one sinner who repents. I think that's in the same chapter too.